judge of the U.S. District Court for the District of Nebraska. And it's an honor and a privilege to have you here, and especially to have with us Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Orville D. Menard, who is the author of a book about the trial of Tom Dennison. The book in its current edition that came out in 1988 is available on Amazon.com for about $300 because there are very few copies of it. But the good news is a new edition is coming out in November that is updated. And if you want to read more about Tom Dennison and the trial and the exhibits that you see out there, you'll be able to do that for something under $20. How many people here are employees of the U.S. District Court? Okay, several of you here. Well, as you know, we just went through a government shutdown process that was unpleasant. It was stressful. Those of you who work for the court and those who are not here working for the court had to display a lot of patience and dedication and courage during that period of time, and I want to thank you for that. I got telephone calls from the news media during that period of time asking when the court would be closing its doors. And I said, well, we're not going to close our doors. The work that we do is essential work. It's required under the Constitution. It's required under the federal statutes. We handle criminal cases. We handle civil cases. And what we do is really necessary and essential for civilization. We are not going to close our doors. Well, two examples of why we don't close our doors are downstairs, the Standing Bear exhibit, and this new exhibit that is going to be posted on the other side of the entry to the clerk's office. If the courthouse doors had been closed in 1879, Standing Bear would have been sent back on a trail of tears to Oklahoma and probably would have died en route there, and he never would have been declared a person under the law. And if the courthouse doors had been closed in 1932, the trial of Tom Dennison and the 58 alleged co-conspirators would not have taken place. And theoretically, Omaha might still be operating under a criminal syndicate controlling City Hall and the police department. So we're grateful that you, who work for the court, are willing to keep the courthouse doors open even during trying times, and we are grateful for the inspiration that we can draw from both Standing Bear and from the Tom Dennison trial in a very different way. Now, by way of introduction to Professor Orville Menard's remarks, I am going to read a short foreword. This is the foreword to the new edition of the book, and I also want to mention that not only is Professor Menard's book coming out in the new edition in November, but another book called Cigars and Wires came out earlier this year, just a few months ago. Cigars and Wires begins with the trial of Tom Dennison in some great detail and then goes on with more information about criminal activity in Omaha after that trial. Then Professor Menard's book begins, in the late 1800s and carries through to 1932-33 with the trial of Tom Dennison near the end. But this is the foreword to the new edition, and it's about 5 minutes, but I think that it will give you a feel for what the book is about and give a decent introduction to Professor Menard's remarks. Please have a seat. No, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to see a story of murder, greed, corruption, violence, exploitation, adultery, and treachery, All those things we hold dear to our hearts. This opening line from the Broadway musical Chicago could be used to describe the book by Professor Orville Menard that you are about to read. But Chicago was a fictional account of Prohibition-era corruption in the Midwest. Professor Menard's book is true. Chicago was a comedy. Professor Menard's book may make you smile as you reflect on the eternal foibles of human nature, but it will make you cringe as you learn how a city can lose its integrity and its very soul. If you enjoyed the Ken Burns series Prohibition, if you were riveted to the screen watching Tom Hanks in Road to Perdition, if you are fascinated by J. Edgar Hoover, his G-Men, and the denizens of the underworld they brought to justice, this book is for you. It tells the story of some of the most colorful and exciting characters of Omaha's past. It describes some of Omaha's proudest moments and the most shameful. It tells a story of murder, greed, corruption, violence, exploitation, treachery, collaboration, acquiescence, and willful blindness. In some ways, it is a how-to book for those who want to build a political machine linked to a crime syndicate. But it also tells a story of heroism. The mayor who nearly sacrificed his life standing up to a lynch mob 4,000 strong. The honest public servants who risked their lives to bring members of the crime syndicate to justice. Journalists who reported the truth and reformers who never gave up. Used wisely, this is a how-to book for those who want to ensure that political bossism never takes root in American cities again. For me, it's personal. This book records a history I do hold dear to my heart. In 1898, when my grandparents were still courting, Omaha was a model magical city that hosted the Trans-Mississippi Exposition, a World's Fair that welcomed 2.6 million visitors and inspired L. Frank Baum to write The Wizard of Oz. The city's future was as bright as the thousands of newfangled incandescent lights that illuminated the exposition's grand court. In 1900, my grandparents operated a grocery store at 1403 Douglas Street, next door to Omaha's Budweiser Saloon. Husbands and fathers who spent all their earnings in Omaha's gambling houses, saloons, and other places of adult entertainment came to the store for groceries on credit. My grandfather was a Scottish immigrant with a staunch Calvinist upbringing. So if the sinner seemed repentant and could recite a verse from the Bible, the family got groceries. In 1903, my grandparents closed their store, deeply in debt, and for the next 30 years became an integral part of Omaha's reform movement. The reformers had one mission, to break the back of the political machine and crime syndicate run by Tom Dennison, the enigmatic man who controlled Omaha's city hall, police force, and vice enterprises, operating quietly from the back of the Budweiser Saloon. The reformers made progress. They declared a victory when their candidates gained control of Omaha's city hall in 1918. Then, on September 28, 1919, Omaha saw its darkest day. Professor Menard describes in chilling detail how a lynch mob gathered force, losing all sense of honor and humanity. My grandfather was at the Douglas County Courthouse on that fateful Sunday night, trying to save the files of the clerk of the district court as the mob set fire after fire and slashed the hoses of the firefighters. No one could save the human target of the mob's mission. In a Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial following the riot, the Omaha World Herald said, "Omaha was operating under the rule of the wolf pack." Dennison's nickname was the Old Gray Wolf. At the next election, Dennison's machine was in control of Omaha's City Hall once again. In 1929, my grandfather and his oldest son were admitted to the Nebraska bar on the same day. My father, Edson Smith, began work as an assistant United States attorney responsible for enforcement of America's great experiment, Prohibition. He drafted a code of etiquette for officers investigating Prohibition violations to ensure that there would be a clear difference between law enforcers and law violators, and that the constitutional rights of all suspects would be respected. On August 5, 1932, he filed a grand jury indictment against Tom Dennison, Dennison's chief partner in vice, Billy Nesselhaus, and 57 of their associates for 168 acts of conspiracy to violate the National Prohibition Act. A jury trial began in October and for months drew the attention of news media nationwide. The trial concluded with an unusual twist, but it brought an end to the Denison Nestle House enterprises. Political bossism in Omaha was dead in 1933, long before many other American cities were freed of such an affliction. 60 years later, a few months after my father's death, Professor Orville Menard's compelling book about the Denison era and the federal conspiracy trial was published. I read the book and learned a history of my quiet hometown and my modest father that I never knew. The book and Professor Menard's popular speaking engagements, complete with costumed Denison role play, provoked discussion about the era. Some people wondered whether a political boss was really such a bad thing. After all, Denison ensured that Omaha was independent of the powerful crime syndicates that controlled nearby Kansas City and Chicago. With Denison in charge, Omahans had a go-to guy when they needed to negotiate with the criminal underworld. A benevolent dictatorship is an efficient form of government, and Denison was a man who could be very benevolent and highly efficient. After reading the book, you will make your own judgment about the costs and benefits of political bossism. My view is biased. Since 2001, I've served as a federal district judge. I preside over conspiracy trials involving drug kingpins, human trafficking, money laundering, extortion, bribery, and fraud. But crime syndicates no longer control American city halls and police departments. In the United States, the era of the political boss linked to the underworld has faded. From my vantage, we must never return to that era, and we must help societies abroad understand that the best way to govern is through fair elections and rule of law. On New Year's Eve 2009, I attended a gathering at a neighbor's home and saw a gray-haired man with dark-rimmed glasses and bushy eyebrows sitting quietly in a corner. I sat next to him and said, "I want to tell you something. For many years, I presented workshops on management ethics. For good examples, I told anecdotes about your management style. For bad examples, I told stories about Tom Denison." I didn't expect the man to recognize Denison's name, but he became animated and said, "Oh, I know all about Denison. I live in the house that was owned by Denison's bagman, Billy Nesselhouse. I think Billy hid his treasure in there somewhere, and I'm still looking for it." I asked if he would like a copy of Professor Menard's book about Tom Denison, and he said yes. But when I tried to buy a copy, it was out of print. So I gave Mr. Buffett my copy. He later told me he read it cover to cover and enjoyed it very much. I told Professor Menard his book must not be allowed to remain out of print. It tells a story from which timeless lessons should be drawn. The book is entertaining, but it is entertainment with a purpose. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. The curtain is about to rise. I give you Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Orville D. Menard, the author of the newly titled book, River City Empire. Professor Menard.
I tell you what. That foreword you just heard is better than the rest of the book. So I'm indebted, you know, to her for that and for inviting us here today. It's good to be with you and talk about Tom Denison some more. And inviting my wife and I to come down here today. She's my deliverer, by the way. Moving the wheels here. But in a few remarks, I want to tell you about a 30-some-year career of Tom Denison, Omaha's boss. Now, one thing to keep in mind with bosses is that they were almost the same from town to town. That people were able to travel around the country in the early 20th century giving speeches about bosses. And what they would do, they would take this template and fill in the names when they got there. And you can do the same thing. What were the bosses? You read out in the hallway, you know, some of the activities of the bosses, some of them just mentioned. And again, same sort of thing. Ballot box stuffing, electoral fraud, protection of criminal enterprises, gambling, bootlegging. It's all there from city to city. So to talk about Tom Dennison is to talk about all those other bosses. So you're probably familiar with Pendergast, Boss Tweed, Daley. But missing from that list for a long time was Tom Dennison. And so we try to fill a gap there of our knowledge about bossism. So more about it, as we can provide some sort of a background for you as you look at the pictures that are appearing in those screens in front of you. That with the political bosses, Tom Dennison again, that the end of bossism, you know, came from many causes. But in Omaha, the situation that developed into the demise of the Dennison machine was the Dennison trial of 1932. And in Omaha, you had all those crimes and such, and the police department's domination by the political machine, City Hall controlled by the Dennison commissioners, and these individuals, you know, with the, you know, two groups really. You have one group that is down in the third ward, the River wards, pretty much third ward, the old market. And those were the wards that Dennison firmly controlled. These were the wards that he was able to provide protection for the gamblers, for the prostitutes, dopists. And with that medium, he got money. It is, how are these people getting this protection? They paid for it. They paid for it to the police department. And thus, Dennison was able to provide some of the money for welfare activities. When you hear about the bosses and all of the good things they did, helping the poor, helping the needy, helping the donors, money. But he also got money from the establishment, you know, the upper-class legitimate businessmen, that they too needed favors. They needed favors from the city commission because there were things that they wanted. They wanted easements. They wanted rights and ways. They wanted electoral testing, not quite as stringent as it could be. Well, they were buying those favors. And that, again, became part of the machine's coffers and enabling it to engage in those activities. Now, over the years, here, all these underground kind of activities, or illegal activities, are going on in the city. And reformers in the city throughout these years wanted to get rid of Tom Dennison. But they couldn't do it with the ballot box. And in 1918, they did. They got in for a short time of time. But rather quickly, they decided to bring Dennison back. They talked to some of the old-timers, and they would tell you Dennison kept the lid on. And he did. That the murder rates and robberies and such, they were occurred, but they were under a certain control mechanism of Tom Dennison with his work through the police department. So all these years, a man by the name of Jim Dorman was being elected mayor. Now, Jim Dorman was not a member of the machine per se, but he was part of the operation in order to keep control of the city in Tom Dennison's hands. He was a cowboy, Cowboy Jim Dorman. There was another man you have to keep in mind, Billy Nesselhaus. That Billy Nesselhaus was Tom Dennison's right-hand man. That Tom Dennison was a fellow who was a bit Puritan in a way, who did not drink, he didn't smoke. If somebody came to his office who had been drinking, Dennison wouldn't deal with him. And so I'm not going to deal with anybody whose mind is kind of mixed up with booze. And these two men worked together. Tom Dennison usually through the less tainted activities of the machine, you know, patronage and communication to city commissioners, the prostitution, the gambling and such. This was Billy Nesselhaus's activity. As the judge mentioned, Buffett and the rumors that were in that house of Billy Nesselhaus, money hidden. Mr. Buffett wrote us a letter, and he said, Professor, if you find any of that money, I'll split it with you. Haven't got around to you ever looking. So after all these years, you know, Dennison and his cohorts are working on the hoof. And how do you get rid of this guy? How do you get rid of them? How do you break the power of the machine? And it went to the courts. Now, courts were used in other cities to get at the machine, but they did it through civil trials and such, and tax evasion. So you get people like Pendergast goes to prison, but he goes to prison because of income tax evasion. And the same thing in other cities. But in Omaha, they decided to take another tact. That let's go back through all those years of all of these nefarious activities. And if we get him into court and we publicize these activities, we might be able to vote him out. And that's what happened. That in 1932, they got indictments against all of these Denison men and indicted them for a conspiracy to violate the prohibition laws. And it was a conspiracy trial. And in those days, conspiracy was something that was pretty much admitted to the court. Didn't have to really be tied to the case in front of them. So for 2 months, Onahans found out what was really going on. So all these years, there was a notion of these things going on, but nobody was really disturbed by it. There's going to be gambling, there's going to be prostitution, so. But now for 2 months, day after day after day, Onahans are reading in the newspapers about jury tampering, they're reading about ballot box stuffing, they're reading about murders, and this takes hold of the public imagination. So why 1932? Well, in the end of 1931, there was a very influential and important Omaha businessman and philanthropist, and he was murdered down by Hanscom Park. So a small group of men got together and said, you know, that now we have a shooting that people can respond to or get upset about. Because all those other previous shootings and such were bootlegger shooting bootleggers. They were getting what they deserved, but not Harry Lapidus. So they got involved with it, they got federal agents came to Omaha, they put wiretaps out all over town, and the result was the indictment. And the indictment for conspiracy, but this publicity over all these months, that even after all the activities were put in the newspapers for 2 months, Denison was, and his cohorts were not found guilty, went to a hung jury. Now there's some evidence that there were a couple of guys who were fixed on the jury, which was not a new enterprise for Tom Denison people. They had been fixing juries for years. But the damage had been done politically. Denison and the machine never recovered from that. And in the spring of that year, the elections, the Denison machine was voted out. A couple of years later, Denison was in California. He left town after that. He knew he was done. And he went to California in 1934, died of a stroke, an automobile accident. So with that, it's kind of a background or overview. And no one would take more of your time about these things at this point. If you'd like to ask questions about him, we can do so at the reception, which I understand is to follow. And I'll be happy to take your questions. So with that, thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience. And I hope that provides enough of an overview to let you know what we're talking about. So thank you. I might know what I'm, not know what I'm talking about, but that's what it goes. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Menard. And the professor indicated he'd be happy to answer questions at the reception. And we also have with us Jack Atkins, who was involved with the publication of the other book that I mentioned earlier, Cigars and Wires. And he'll probably be happy to answer questions for you, too, at the reception. That will be directly to the south in the Eighth Circuit Conference Room. So we will see you over there. Thank you.
Can I make one comment?
Yes.
Yeah, we let them know that the title of River City Empire was the
press
is not mine.
Was the press is, oh. I like the title. yes, River City Empire was the press's idea, not Professor Menard's idea. Again, River City Empire, their idea, not his. Okay, thank you. Jack?
I'd like to make a comment. Since I'm the son of one of the bootleggers in Omaha, I offered to spike the punch in the next room. However, the judge informed me that my dad didn't get your dad, but I can get you.
We'll see you over there for non-alcoholic beverages.